Today in Studio 360, we send a reporter to check out a museum show where all the art is made of dirt.
The show that we're about to see is dedicated to, quote, stuff we leave behind or deem unclean or strive to remove or discard or disguise or hide.
And he was accompanied by an expert, a Class A slob.
I set my apartment on fire recently. I don't cook that often, but when I do, I really hit it out of the park.
And later in the show, the only in America story of musician and mogul Herb Alpert.
You know how you make $1 million playing jazz, by the way? You start with $3 million.
Plus, the economy's finally getting better, but not so much on our TV shows. That's all ahead today in Studio 360, right after this.
You're listening to the podcast of Studio 360 from Public Radio International and WNYC, where each week Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. We have a great website, too. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
Support for Studio 360 is provided by Live from Lincoln Center, broadcasting Renee Fleming at the Penthouse with special guest Josh Groban, Friday, April 6th at 9. Broadcast times are available through local PBS listings. And by Scion, making vehicles for today's connected youth and offering over 150 accessories to choose from to fit any lifestyle. Learn more at scion.com. Scion, what moves you?
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. On today's show, I'll talk with the author of We Need to Talk About Kevin, a novel about being the mother of a young murderer, and her new novel about terrorism. Lionel Shriver thinks that when violence happens, we tend to ask the wrong questions.
Coming to a conclusion as to whose fault something is doesn't really get you very far. Does it make people alive that should still be alive? Does it really help you to prevent these things happening again? Generally not.
But first, let's talk about the economy, which finally seems like it's getting back on track. Job creation is robust. Unemployment's closer to 8% than 10%. Even the American auto industry, almost left for dead 3 years ago, is back. Remember that Super Bowl commercial for Chrysler with Clint Eastwood?
This country can't be knocked out with one punch. We get right back up again, and when we do, the world's going to hear the roar of our engines. Yeah, it's halftime, America. And our second half's about to begin.
But elsewhere on television, it seems like it's 2009 and we're continuing to suffer through the Great Recession. From network sitcoms to hour-long dramas, America is still supposed to be down and out. James Poniewozik is the television critic and pop culture commentator for Time magazine. He's here with me now. James, welcome to Studio 360.
Thanks for having me.
So you have described in Time TV as a lagging economic indicator. What do you mean and why is that?
It means that it took a while for them to acknowledge that the recession was happening. And television tends to get to the zeitgeist, you know, a year or whatever after the zeitgeist has been there.
Let's unpack how this works a little bit. First of all, I presume if one is a network television executive, just the idea of depicting a terrible, abysmal economy doesn't make you want to greenlight a show, for starters.
I think that's true. I mean, network television is conditioned against airing anything that could be considered a bummer. And then there's also sort of a more systemic thing in TV, which is that TV tends to program now for demographics. You used to have things like the Norman Lear comedies. You used to have Archie Bunker and then Roseanne, you know, actual normal working people doing blue-collar jobs.
That everybody was supposed to watch.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, more or less everybody did watch. And then as TV became more fragmented, suddenly you started doing shows about Frasier Crane because you wanted Frasier Crane watching your show. You wanted people with high levels of disposable income. And thus, for a while, it's been kind of unfashionable to show sort of blue-collar, working-class families and people in, say, sitcoms.
So Friends replaced Roseanne.
Exactly.
This recession that we are now escaping was unusually deep and long for any recessions we've experienced in our lifetime. Did that, do you think, give TV the thought that, well, this is a real thing. Now we can greenlight those shows that are set against a rotten economy.
Yeah, I think that's true. You know, you had the collapse of the financial industry in 2008, and that meant by last spring and fall, once some of these shows started getting greenlighted, you still had a struggling economy going out there when the networks started putting on things like, say, Two Broke Girls on CBS, which was actually a sitcom premised around people being out of money.
And it's in the title. They can't really walk that back.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I don't think it's going to become Two Recovering Girls, you know, once the housing starts go up.
Two girls with decent jobs.
Level. Yeah.
This is too much. That couple that just left, a $50 check, a $1.47 tip. 47 cents? I wasn't even aware they were still making pennies.
What other shows sort of look to you in the TV landscape as if they're behind the curve?
One thing that has sort of struck me is there's a new Lifetime show, which is starting in April, called The Client List.
I've seen the ads for it.
I'm sure you have. Jennifer Love Hewitt and her cleavage have been on billboards and ads all over for this. And essentially, it is an update of a Lifetime movie in which Jennifer Love Hewitt played a woman down on her luck, hitting hard times, who takes a job in a massage parlor that turns out to be that kind of massage parlor.
90% of what we do here is legit. So do you always buy the girls something special to wear?
So I was work.
Good, okay.
Geez, could you be more vague?
This job is all about being flexible.
So that's The Client List. When did you first begin noticing this, that TV was going in the recessionary direction?
You know, I think I probably started noticing it first and most often in reality TV, which I think a little more quickly started developing ideas that related to, you know, tough times or scrounging. Pawn Stars,
right.
Like extreme couponing,
right.
Like Storage Wars, which is, you know, both a very fascinating kind of treasure hunt show, and also, when you think about it, an extremely depressing show about people rummaging through the possessions of people who've been foreclosed on.
Yeah. Do we assume, since, you know, new scripts are being written as we speak, that those things are being wrung out of scripts?
You know, I kind of tend to doubt that, you know, that they're looking at the latest weekly unemployment figures and adjusting accordingly. but I do think that it speaks to the fact that once you have this idea established in the public mind, in the mind of your audience, that times are tough out there, it's hard to get a job, et cetera, it takes a while before you want to sort of go against that established idea. And it has some benefits. If, say, you're writing a drama, it provides motivation. And if one of those things is that, well, it's tough to get a job out there, you're under financial pressures, you're scared, that can be a better motivation for drama and for characters than great times can be.
James Poniewozik, thanks so much.
Thanks a lot.
James Poniewozik is the television critic for Time Magazine. This weekend, the country formerly known as Burma is holding democratic elections. These are the first real elections in decades. The ongoing democratic transformation in Burma, knock wood, is ending the 50-year isolation of the country, and everybody there has something at stake. Including these guys, a punk band called Side Effect. They're in Yangon, Burma's biggest city, and they want a global audience. Ike Sriskandaraja has their story.
No flashlight app?
Yeah, that would be great.
There's a blackout in Yangon, but Side Effect's frontman Darko C makes the most of it. Candlelight's not that bad.
It's nice, yeah. Nice and beautiful, huh?
He huddles around the flame in a studio space with his bandmates Joseph.
Yeah, I'm Joseph. Yeah, I'm the guitarist.
Yeah, and Joseph is my little brother.
And Setu.
Hi, my name is Setu. I am the drummer from Side Effect.
Side Effect's story sounds like every band story you've ever heard. A group of friends starts playing music for fun. This was back in 2004. They don't have the best gear. Setu doesn't even own a drum.
I just practice at my home with the books. Yeah, books and stick.
That's punk rock.
Glam rock? Sure.
They wanted to sound like the Strokes, the White Stripes, and Nirvana, but nobody around understands their music. And at local venues, they run up against the cover acts.
The bands that play there are like cover bands, playing the Cranberries and the Cars.
Sure.
And yeah, Hotel California, that kind of thing.
It gets worse, actually. Burmese Justin Bieber. When they do get on stage, the audience is half their friends and the other half is confused.
Yeah, they didn't like our music and stuff, so, you know, they were just standing there, you know, staring at us, and, you know, a guy, he shouted at us that, you know, he would pay, like, $40,000 for us to go back to our home.
No chump change.
And then we told them that, no, we won't. We're gonna play, like, 65 songs. And he was sad. We don't really care, you know, we just go on and on and on.
Finally, they were ready to put out an album. But then this band story stopped sounding like every other. Darko had to take his lyrics to the censorship authority, controlled by the military junta.
You gotta do what you gotta do, right? So, yeah, we don't have a choice.
Darko had two songs rejected. Not for politics, but for morals. One's about a prostitute.
Like a hooker. So she was looking for a client during the night, and then she was just followed by a drunken, you know, thugs, and then she had to run away. I wrote that song, I mean, to be funny, but they didn't really find that funny, and they banned that song, and yeah, we were like, yeah, okay, f*** it.
The censors had banned songs for mentioning cigarettes or alcohol, but Side Effect got this one through. YYY, Burmese for getting drunk. A victory in the fight for the right to party. But they still didn't have any money. So like independent bands all over the world, they decided to put out a hat. On the internet, with a crowdfunding site called Indiegogo. Side Effect only had a few fans in Burma, but on Indiegogo, they won over an international audience to the tune of $3,000.
We thought that was great, you know, they were very kind to us and, you know, their messages to us, it was very touching, you know.
Setu was going to buy his own drums and Side Effect could release their debut album.
But then
it's still Myanmar.
We got that message from Indiegogo that our account has been frozen because it violates the rules of U.S. sanctions.
Everyone is waiting for those sanctions to lift, maybe after this weekend's election. But Secretary Hillary Clinton recently said before lifting the sanctions, the State Department wanted to see all remaining political prisoners released. There may be nearly 1,700. An end to violence in ethnic minority areas. And proof of fair elections. That could take a while. Darko takes it in stride.
I don't really want to blame them about their sanctions towards Myanmar. I can understand the situation, but, you know, politics is more complex than physics, right?
Side Effect has spent their career steering clear of politics, singing about drinking and women. But the new freedoms are intoxicating.
Now it's okay. I think, you know, we got the chance to use Twitter, and now people can find us on YouTube, Facebook, and yeah, SoundCloud, and Reverb Nation.
Hey, they say it's time to change, the change we've always wanted.
So Side Effect has to get political. In their practice space during a blackout, Darko is trying to capture the feeling of what's happening in Myanmar right now, with lyrics in English for all you independent music fans out there.
Can you hear me out? You just slowed us down with your sanctions, but you'll never understand our broken dreams. Oh,
for Studio 360, I'm Ike Srikandarajan.
And you can hear some of Side Effect songs fully produced at studio360.org. Coming up, the novelist Lionel Shriver and how she got to be Lionel Shriver.
So I was filling out a name tag very early in my sophomore year, and I put down Lionel instead of Margaret, and I just stuck with it.
That's ahead this hour in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion. Scion, making vehicles for today's connected youth and offering over 150 accessories to choose from to fit any lifestyle. Learn more at scion.com. Scion, what moves you?
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Lionel Shriver's latest novel, The New Republic, is about a freshly minted reporter who gets posted to a place, a fictional place, called Barba. It's a dump, a backwater province of Portugal. But there's a shadowy terrorist group known as the SOB that wants Barba to be independent. They've claimed responsibility for dozens of bombings all over Europe.
Edgar slumped into the rattletrap taxi, glad that darkness spared him gaping out the window. He didn't have the energy to be fascinated, and wanted to appraise his new home with a fresh eye. Edgar had already formed a nascent affection for Barba, if only because Lisboners seemed to hate it so much. A kicked cur as a kid, Edgar identified with outcasts more than most of his countrymen, whose reputation for sympathy with underdogs was, in his view, highly exaggerated.
And Edgar's first journalistic task in Barba is to find out what happened to his predecessor, a famous reporter who's disappeared.
Fighting nausea as the taxi threw him from door to door, Edgar kicked himself for promising to stop by Nicola's little soiree tonight. Better to have picked up the key tomorrow and sprung for a hotel. He vowed to get in, then to get out. So far, his fellow journalist had hardly constituted a mutually supportive intellectual fraternity, and one carelessly ignorant remark about the SOB could take him months to live down. Edgar admonished himself, "Keep your pie hole shut."
That's Lionel Shriver reading from The New Republic, and she is here with me now. Welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you.
So you lived in Belfast, in Northern Ireland, during the 1990s, during the last years of the Troubles, with bombings and other killings still rife. How much of your experience there is transmuted into this book?
I would say what I learned is transferred to the book, but the place is not. That is, by the time I left Northern Ireland in 1999, I'd been there 12 years, and please, Belfast, don't take this wrong, but I was sick of it. Though I felt that the experience of living there had been revelatory in some ways, in some pretty depressing ways, which is to say, one of the things we don't appreciate is the fact that terrorism works. And I saw it work close up. The people who were bombing mainland Britain and assassinating political opponents, they're running the place now.
Your book does lay some blame for terrorism on the media's coverage of it, sort of as a dark joke in the book. How much do you actually believe that to be the case in a general sense?
It's certainly a symbiotic relationship. They need each other. And I'm really torn on this issue because I don't believe in repressing the press. When violence occurs, it seems as if it's worth covering. The trouble is that journalists act as magnifiers for terrorists. And without the press, terrorism doesn't have the same effect.
Yeah.
And so I think we're really between a rock and a hard place on this one.
This book is essentially a comedy about terrorism, and you actually wrote it before 9/11. Did you and your editors think about the book differently before and after those attacks in 2001?
Well, when I finished the novel in 1998, I did try to publish it, and I just couldn't stir any interest. You know, ironically, after 9/11, terrorism became, you know, if anything, too central
right.
to American culture and politics. And publishing this book immediately after 9/11 would have seemed like jumping on the bandwagon, you know, because
right.
suddenly everyone was writing about terrorism. And furthermore, it would have seemed, I'm afraid, tasteless.
Right.
Because this it's funny. And I really had to wait until now to publish this book just to not seem insensitive.
This rookie reporter, who's your protagonist, Edgar, repeatedly describes himself as a put-upon person, a former fat kid.
A former fat boy looking for love.
Exactly. And even though he hasn't been fat for a long, long time, that is still the core of who he is. Is there some defective version of Lionel Shriver that you no longer are that is informing that character?
Well, nobody's ever asked me that, but I think there probably is. I had buck teeth when I was a kid. So I know what it's like to be mocked. I know what it's like to be rather low down on the totem pole. And I think that has informed my life. I'm hopeful that it hasn't turned me into a cynic and a total misanthrope.
Yeah.
But I do think it's important for your understanding of the world, even if you've ended up turning out, you know, fairly attractive, to know what it's like on the other side.
Mm-hmm.
People who are attractive don't realize how nice people are to them because they look pretty, and they have no idea how other people are treated.
Yeah. Tell me how it happened that you changed your name to Lionel, and how old you were and what that was all about.
Well, I never especially identified with my first name, which is Margaret.
Right.
And when I was at home, it was Margaret Ann. And, you know, there's nothing wrong with that name. I hope my parents don't take it personally, but it just didn't seem like my name. And I tried to get rid of it for the first time was when I was 8 years old. I tried to change it to Tony. But, hell, I was only 8 years old. What do you want? But when I was 15, my family moved from Raleigh, North Carolina to Atlanta, and I knew that that was my chance.
Uh-huh.
And if I didn't take it, it would never come around again. So I was filling out a name tag very early in my sophomore year. That was my first year in Atlanta. And I put down Lionel instead of Margaret. And I just stuck with it.
And was that from the Barrymores or from the trains?
Well, you know, at that time, I never even heard of Lionel Trains. And for years, people kept saying, like the trains? And I'd look at them blankly.
No, like the Barrymores.
I think I chose it because I didn't know anybody named Lionel. It didn't have strong associations,
right.
And so that it was easy for it to become my name.
And in the author photo on this book, you're a man. You're dressed as a man. what was that all about?
The director of We Need to Talk About Kevin impulsively gave me her hat. And it's a, you know, it's a man's hat, like a fedora with a little feather in it. And so I'm wearing that hat partly as a tribute to her.
I want to talk about We Need to Talk About Kevin, which was your breakthrough book when it came out, I guess, 8 years ago. It's about the mother of a boy who becomes a killer. And became a movie last year, starring Tilda Swinton as the mother. Kevin is horribly messed up. His mother fears because she didn't entirely love him. Is that an interpretation of the story that stands, that you stand by?
Well, the book poses the question, did the kid turn out badly because his mother didn't love him, or did his mother not love him because there's
something
wrong with the kid?
Yeah.
Right? And that's a question that the book itself never quite answers. I'd say that the film tends to err on the side of the kid is evil.
Mm-hmm.
I think that kind of
moral ambivalence would have been very difficult to capture in cinema. And I can live with that.
The question of blame for terrorism in the New Republic, for who made Kevin into a bad actor, is a prominent theme in your books. And I wondered if that is just a thing that interests you.
Well, it's a primary theme in Western culture. And that's probably more interesting to me than in any given situation whose fault something is. And certainly at the end of Kevin, you get told in those uncertain terms that the narrator finally decides that she's been worrying about the wrong thing, that she's been asking herself the wrong question, and therefore the reader has been asking the wrong question. That coming to a conclusion as to whose fault something is doesn't really get you very far. And, you know, when we have real school shootings, one of the first things people ask is, whose fault is it? Well, where does that get you? Does it make it unhappen? Does it make people alive that should still be alive? Does it really help you to prevent these things happening again? Generally not. And I am disinclined to try to feed this hunger for pinning culpability.
Even as you like to raise the question.
Of course.
Yeah.
I like to have it both ways.
Lionel Shriver, thank you very much.
I really enjoy talking to you.
Lionel Shriver's new book is called The New Republic, no relation to the magazine. Last week on the show, we kicked off our new short story contest inspired by the forthcoming book Significant Objects. At a thrift shop, we bought three vintage items. And now it's up to you. Pick one of those items, write a fictional backstory about it, and post that story to our website. Submissions are already coming in.
Hi, this is John from Washington, D.C., and I chose to write about the Marlboro Thermos. I'm not a smoker, but my dad smoked. He was a Marlboro man, not in the rugged cowboy sense, but it was his brand. He switched from L&M when Marlboro offered two free packs with the purchase of a thermos.
My name is Byra Zimmerman from Ashburn, Virginia, and I chose to write about the wooden thing. Two nuts, two bolts, and two pieces of wood. All you need is a little imagination, he said. All you need is to try, he said. All you need is to make something, he said. Finish something, he said.
There is still time for you to enter. The deadline's April 8th, so you've got two more weeks. Go to studio360.org for all the details. Come on, admit it. You sometimes stare, half in shame, half in awe, at the dust bunnies gathered under your bed, or at the astonishing constellation of crumbs under your toaster, or the gunk behind the radiator. Well, there's a big exhibition in New York City right now that takes dirt connoisseurship to unprecedented heights. It's called Swept Away, and it's at the Museum of Arts and Design. Every artwork in the show is entirely made out of dirt or dust, trash, pollution, schmutz. We asked Henry Alford to go check it out, and he brought along a buddy, the biggest slob he knows.
The show that we're about to see is dedicated to, quote, stuff we leave behind or deem unclean or strive to remove or discard or disguise or hide.
Okay.
Am I making you nervous?
No. This is like my apartment.
Yeah.
This makes sense to me.
That's Dave Hill. He's a writer and comedian who's been on HBO and Cinemax and This American Life. He lives in a pigsty.
My apartment, is It's not like Oscar Madison gross.
Actually, it's way worse than Oscar Madison. A while back, Dave had an infestation of moths. He bombed the apartment, but then didn't bother to clean up after the bombing. Worse, a few months later, he had a nasty surprise when he pulled out an oriental rug he'd stowed under his bed.
The oriental rug was like sort of bubbling like its own ecosystem of like larvae and moths in various states of cocoonery or something. I had to take a good hard look at myself after that.
We went upstairs to the exhibition. The first piece we looked at was a Paul Hazelton sculpture in which the artist had smushed a dust-covered cleaning cloth into the shape of a human skull.
It looks really like, I feel like he had a real skull to work with. That's what frightens me about it.
Oh, that he pressed the cleaning cloth against a real skull to get the shape right?
So, yeah, or had one, like, in the one hand, and he was like, wait, I didn't get that weird nose thing that happens with skulls, right?
Yeah, it is now creepy.
He nailed it. Imagine if you just found this in your closet, only you didn't make it on purpose. You would have to move.
Next, we looked at something called a soil map.
So here's an 8-foot by 10-foot plastic tray filled with 15 years worth of soil samples taken from all 5 boroughs of New York City.
I was going to guess that's what this was.
Dave was unfazed by the cubic yards of dirt before him.
I guess it goes without saying everything's covered in urine. This is the theory that I came up with in my spare time. And then one night, I met a guy, some sort of epidemiologist, like a public health person. So I said, tell me if I'm right. Is everything covered in semen and feces? And he said, yeah, basically. So I said, good. This is what I've been saying since, you know, the 80s. No one is safe. You can't run from it, basically.
Wow. I want to rinse. I need to ablute.
No, you can't. What's that mean?
Ablutions. I need to make my ablutions.
Ablutions? Is that French? How do you spell that?
We looked at a series of wooden sculptures of crows, all of which had been burned to charcoal.
What's interesting is, A, it smells, right? You can smell the fire.
Does.
And some of the charcoal's gotten up on the walls and it's smeared.
Yeah. This might be my favorite. I set my apartment on fire recently. I don't cook that often, but when I do, I really hit it out of the park.
When we stood in front of a quilt made from dryer lint, Hill got to talking about how it's sometimes easier just to buy new underwear rather than wash an old pair, but that sometimes in his haste, he absentmindedly buys underwear that's not the right size.
I wear the underwear that's too big, and it grates at me. And that's what's going on with me right now.
But can't you just cinch up the waistband?
You can cinch all day, but it's never going to solve the problem. I mean, look at it. It's a mess.
Oh,
and you can see.
Yeah, that's right. There are little pictures of crabs on the underwear. That kind of sends a message.
Yeah. Know who you're dealing with.
Toward the end of the exhibition, Dave started to reflect on what he'd learned from the show.
I realized a few things. Is that there's beauty in the most unexpected things if you just push it together into a cool shape eventually.
Do you think this exhibition will make non-messy people warm up to messy people?
What I hope that it does, aside from make for some great first dates, is wakes people up to the fact that we're all messy people. Literally messy, emotionally messy, spiritually messy.
Psychotically messy.
And covered in semen and feces.
On the way out, we stopped to look at one more thing, a work by an Italian artist named Antonio Riello. He'd incinerated his favorite books and then put the ashes in hand-blown glass decanters and beakers. The burned books made us a little uncomfortable, but the hand-blown glass was beautiful.
He does a lot of fancy reading. Some of these are in other languages. Also, they misspelled Walt Whitman.
Oh, it says Walt Withman.
Talk about slobbiness.
Ugh, nothing drives me crazier than typos. Improper punctuation, things like that. I don't always speak eloquently, but my spelling is impeccable.
For Studio 360, I'm Henry Alford.
Swept Away is at the Museum of Arts and Design in New York through the summer. Dave Hill's book, Tasteful Nudes, is coming out in May. And Henry Alford's latest book is A New Guide to Manners. It's called Would It Kill You to Stop Doing That? Coming up, a young trumpeter from L.A. goes to a bullfight in Tijuana, and American music has never been the same.
There was this brass band in the stands that would announce all the events. There was something about that feeling that I thought maybe I could translate it into a sound.
Herb Alpert on the invention of his Tijuana brass. That's just ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion. Scion, making vehicles for today's connected youth and offering over 150 accessories to choose from to fit any lifestyle. Learn more at scion.com. Scion, what moves you?
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. In the mid-1960s, I was into the music cool kids were supposed to be into, the Beatles, the Stones. But I also listened to my parents' albums by Herb Alpert and the Tijuana Brass. That loungy, jazzy, sometimes James Bondy pseudo-Latino music spoke to a boy of 11 going on 12. And although my tastes evolved with the times, Herb Alpert kept making easy-listening number one hits. It's hard to overstate Alpert's influence on pop music. Not only has he kept writing and performing big hits himself over the last half century, but he co-founded A&M Records and thereby helped launch lots of big careers from the Carpenters to the Police. Herb Alpert is turning 77 this weekend, but he's still releasing jazz albums, still touring and performing, and still starting every day practicing for a half hour on the trumpet.
You know, I was very lucky in my grammar school. They had a music appreciation class, and there were a bunch of instruments on a table. And I happened to pick out the trumpet, and I tried to make some sound out of it, and I couldn't, which intrigued me. And I was very, very shy as a young kid. So when I finally did make noise out of it, it was speaking for me.
And did you do more than just the songs they make you play in school bands? Were you, like, picking up jazz riffs?
I'm fortunate I have very good relative pitch, so if I hear a song on the radio, I can just play it right back. And I don't know how it happens. I just seem to press the right valves.
So you were suddenly the Charlie Parker of your set?
Well, I wouldn't go that far. No, I was, you know, I have a very classical background. When I was going to USC, I was playing in the orchestra there, and they were playing Pictures at an Exhibition by Mussorgsky that was arranged by Ravel. And I got so enamored with the sound of the orchestra, I was leaning forward. I was in the back row with the trumpet section. I was leaning forward, listening to this thing, and it sounded. I said, man, that's great. It sounds like stereo or something. You know, it's just a beautiful sound. And I forgot to come in. I forgot to play my part. So right from that point, I just said, hey, you know something, I'm not that interested in playing other people's music. I want to close my eyes and just, you know, invent my own thing.
How interesting, though, that this classic romantic piece, Mussorgsky and Ravel, that seems right for Herb Alpert to have sort of lost his mind over.
Well, it certainly washed over me, and I'm a big fan of Ravel. I love his, you know, his drama. There's something about but the way he orchestrated that really touched me. You know, little by little, I was looking for my own voice. I was drafted in the Army in 1954, and they sent me to band school in Fort Knox, Kentucky.
And no war going on, fortunately.
Well, that was very fortunate. So I go to band school in Fort Knox, Kentucky, and I run into like 12 trumpet players that were, they were better than me, man.
Really?
Oh, yeah. They could play higher, faster, louder. Better jazz. You know, they were just something that really made me think, if I'm ever going to make it in this music industry, I better come up with my own identity. And that's what I worked on when I was released.
And you were also working on being a producer. I mean, you helped discover Sam Cooke and Janet
Dean.
Well,
no, I didn't discover Sam Cooke. I was working for the company along with Lou Adler. Lou Adler and I were partners, and we worked for this Keen Records and became really good friends with Sam. We wrote A Wonderful World with him, Don't Know Much About History, that song. And I learned a lot from Sam because he came out of the gospel field. You know, mm-hmm. Everything had to do with a feel. It had to feel good. It had to feel good, you know.
Was that a meaningful thing for you? I mean, as a producer, did you then try to say, okay, I think I know what he means and try to feel it?
Well, he used to say, Herbie, it's a cold piece of wax, man. It either makes it or it don't.
I hold you responsible for so much of my youth. Tell me the story behind the song that made me hear of you when I was 7 or 8 years old for the first time, The Lonely Bull, which we would play over and over and over again.
Yeah, well, you know, I used to go to bullfights in Tijuana for several years during the spring. They had world-class matadors there, and I kind of got, you know, I became a fan of that.
You would drive down from Southern California?
Drive down from Los Angeles. And there was this brass band in the stands that would announce all the sequence of events. Ba-da, ba-da-da, ba-da-da, ba-da, ba, ole, ba-da, ba-da, ba-da. And the people in the stands would go crazy. And I was kind of taken by that. I liked that feeling. And the more I drank wine out of my boat, the better I liked it. So there was something about that feeling that I thought maybe I could translate it into a sound. And then I played it for a disc jockey friend of mine, and he said, man, you need some hooks. You got to put a hook in there. I said, what do you mean a hook? He says, well, something that people can remember. So an engineer friend of mine, Ted Keeps, had a tape of 30,000 people screaming ole at a bullfight. I put that on right in the front of The Lonely Bull. And months later, I would get cards and letters from people all over the world saying, thanks for taking me on this vicarious trip to Tijuana.
No, and since it didn't really belong in any existing pop category, were you surprised when it became this gigantic hit record?
Yeah, I was taken off guard for sure. Yeah, I didn't think it was going to start a record company. This was the first record we released on A&M. This was A&M 101, and that was the start of...
And you were A of A&M.
I was the A, and that was the start of something really grand.
And then, when I was 11 years old and playing the trumpet in Omaha, Nebraska, came your gigantic album, Whipped Cream.
Right.
1965. And I was just the right age to spend hours staring at the cover mm-hmm. because it was a naked girl, an apparently naked girl covered in whipped cream. And I played the trumpet, and there was all this trumpet was kind of cool suddenly on this record. So you'd been doing Tijuana Brass for a while, but that took it to a new stratosphere.
Well, it did take it to a new level, and... You know, there was no Tijuana Brass group.
There was you.
Yeah, it was a sound that I created while overdubbing my horn on top of my horn, basically up through the Whipped Cream and Other Delights album. And that girl, Dolores Erickson, who was the model on the Whipped Cream cover, she was 3 months pregnant. And also she was covered in shaving cream.
So we couldn't have eaten it. So Tijuana Brass has this plays entirely instrumentals at a time when singer, songwriter, rock and roll is just coming in. You were like the first pop musical brand creator. I mean, it was, you know, I mean, it, really, this band, which, by the way, had no Hispanics in it, playing this Latinish music, is suddenly everywhere. I even remember on the dating game.
It's the dating game. And here's the star of our show, your host, Jim Lyons.
Did you ever worry? Did that worry you, or was getting the royalties good enough?
Worry me about in what sense?
Well, that your music was being reduced to sort of goofy game show theme music.
Oh, I didn't think about it. I couldn't believe all the airplay we were getting and the amount of records we were selling. I mean, there was an experience I had. My partner, there was just the two of us when we started A&M, and my partner, Jerry Moss, one time he got a call from our distributor, and he said, "Herbie, how fast can you send me 104,000 albums?" I said, "You're kidding. You need 104,000. I says, "You must really like this record." He says, "I never heard it, but we're selling a lot of tonnage." I mean, that was the first time I thought of music.
How flattering.
Reduced to weight.
So A&M Records, your label with Jerry Moss, is growing and growing. What acts are you proudest of signing?
Well, I guess the Carpenters, because, yeah. I mean, they were the biggest act we had. I mean, there was something about them that I liked very much when I heard the tape. I heard this tape sitting in my office at A&M, and I had two speakers on the floor, and I was sitting on my couch about 10 feet away from the speakers, closing my eyes, which Sam Cooke taught me to do, by the way. So I closed my eyes, and I was listening to this tape, and it felt like Karen Carpenter's voice was sitting right next to me. Her voice is projected right out of the speakers.
Why do birds suddenly appear every time?
It wasn't the type of music that I would normally listen to, but there was something about them that I really loved.
Just like me, they long to be close to you.
And then the first album that was released by the Carpenters didn't sell at all. I mean, it was like a turkey, as they say.
And this, by the way, is what, 1970?
Yeah, 1970.
So here we have over here Jimi Hendrix and Cream, and here's the Carpenters.
Yeah. The Carpenters didn't sell, and then people in my own company were looking at me like, "Why did you sign these goods?" You know, I mean, if they're too soft, it can't happen. And Karen was playing drums at the time. And I heard the recording, and I said, "This is too soft. We got to put a little energy on this."
So they sprinkle moon dust in your hair, a golden starlight in your eyes of blue. That is why all the girls could sound.
And so they did, and Close You was the door opener for them. And you know, after They zoomed through that door and started selling millions of records. You know, people in my own company were looking at me like, "Man, the guy's not too bad.
He's still got it."
Yeah.
Then you, the next time I remember hearing you as musician as opposed to you as record executive was, I guess, 1979 with the song Rise, which was a disco hit.
Well, it wasn't exactly a disco hit because it happened because my nephew, Randy Alpert, who goes under the name of Captain Badass, by the way, wrote the song with his buddy, Andy Armour, and they wanted me to do the Tijuana Brass records in disco, you know, with the boom, 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 120 beats per minute. I gave it a shot. We went in the studio and started fooling around with Taste of Honey in a disco beat, and I just couldn't handle it. I got nauseous. Quite frankly, I did.
Really?
Well, I just felt like, geez, why trample on it? These songs are already hits, and they were good. Let's just leave them. I had some studio time left, and they had this song called Rise, and they wanted to do it as boom, 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 120 beats per minute. I said, "Look, let's just slow this thing down to 100 beats per minute so people, after they're dancing apart, can get together and dance, you know, a little more romantically." So we did that, and it became a big hit. Ah, yeah, that's that bass line.
There it is.
That's been copied many times.
well, not only copied, but then had a whole new life 20 years later in Biggie's, in Notorious B.I.G.'s song, Hypnotize.
Hypnotize, and it was a big, big, big record.
When you first heard it sampled and looped and used in a hip-hop hit that way, what did you think? Like, I've been around too long? I'm in some loop?
You know something, to tell you the truth, to be quite honest, I'm not crazy about when artists take someone else's material and uses it. That means they can't think for themselves, you know? I'm not regretting that he did it, you know?
Yeah,
it's a big hit record, and it was a good record too.
And you must have done okay with the fees they pay you for sampling that. A lot of jazz musicians would count themselves lucky.
Well, I think so. You know, I think you know how you make $1 million playing jazz. By the way, You start with $3 million. Bada boom, bada boom.
Herb Alpert, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Herb Alpert's latest album with his wife Lonnie Hall is called I Feel You. And that's it for today's show, but don't forget about our Significant Objects contest. It's your opportunity to write short fiction about one of the three pieces of interesting vintage junk that you can see on our website, studio360.org, and get all the details of the contest. Thanks for listening, and I hope you'll listen again next week. Studio 360 is a production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Ital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel,
Derek John,
Jenny Lawton,
Josh Rogerson,
Alana Harper,
Rebecca Lee Douglas,
Thomas Seeley,
Krista Ripple.
Thanks also to WNYC's Chris Bannon. Our theme music is by David Van Tegum.
Studio 360 is funded in part by Ken and Lucy Lehman, who believe that winning workplaces respect, reward, and invest in their employees, and by the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art, and by Scion, making vehicles for today's connected youth and offering over 150 accessories to choose from to fit any lifestyle. Learn more at scion.com. Scion, what moves you?
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360...
I always say that I design all the time. I'm constantly trying to figure out how things are made.
For the fashion designer Isabel Toledo, making clothes is like a never-ending puzzle.
I am thinking construction, design, emotion.
Isabel Toledo, next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
You've been listening to Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson from Public Radio International and WNYC. You can find out more about this episode, access our entire program archive, and leave us a comment at studio360.org.